Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Hello.
Hello.
Here we are. We made it. And my phone's all shiny new. There used to, like, this whole bottom used to just be all cracks. And then it used to just be...
Ooh.
And now... Now it's good.
Oh, that's nice. That's very nice.
It feels nice and smooth. And it feels like a whole brand new phone again. How is your car doing?
Oh, not good. She is not good.
So what happened? Because I don't remember hearing about that before.
And, like, the car's been loud and making noise more than it should. So, like, that's been an ongoing thing for a while, like, months.
Yeah.
So we finally had a chance to actually... We've taken it to another person, but they're like, oh, it's this part, obviously, and that's going to cost you, like, $4,000.
Ugh.
I'm like, well, because they told me I'd have to replace the serpentine belt mechanism the coolant pump. And I was like, well, how do you know I need to get that replaced? And they're like, oh, well, we wouldn't unless we took the whole engine apart.
Yeah.
I'm like, I've been there. So you have absolutely no basis for this decision. Thanks. So then we took it to a place today with the recommendation of one of my coworkers. He likes going to the shop. And when they looked at it and she's like, I'm pretty sure this problem is internal. I can tell you just based on what I'm hearing that this is not a good noise. The car is not happy. And that... Because the radiator fan is coming on, she's like, I'm fairly certain you popped the radiator.
Like, the radiator has a hole in it?
Yeah.
Ooh.
And I'm like...
That's not good.
Because I went in because it's... Every time I had, like, an issue, it'll drop out of gear... And the check engine light tells me that I need, after getting the code read, that I need to get the camshaft position sensor replaced. But it's not a consistent issue. Mm. So, like, the check engine light is turning on and then turning off, like, on its own.
Mm.
So she's like, I think the computer thinks that's what the issue is, but that's not actually the issue.
Right. Yeah, there's either some kind of fault in the sensor that's tripping that, or there's something, like, there really is a problem, but for whatever reason the computer is being tricked into thinking it's a different problem.
Yeah. So basically she's like, it's one of those repairs. She's like, I just don't have the capacity to do all of the necessary things here, because it's like literally just her. And
oh,
maybe
wow.
One other
okay.
person. And I'm like, okay, so we'd have to take it to, like, Honda.
Yeah.
And, like, if it's a radiator issue, like, there's probably other things. And I don't think that that's worth how much the car is.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to look into selling it.
Well, hopefully that will work out, and whoever ends up with it will be very happy. I have personally been on a sort of end of that where I notoriously buy cars that look good, but then end up kind of fucking me over. And the worst incident of that was a car that I owned for literally a day. I had a Subaru Impreza
I loved. A day.
And I mean, like, legally, we signed the paperwork and everything. It was legally my car. And one of the reasons why I seem to be so notorious for this is I don't generally do the work that one should. when like checking out a new vehicle.
I see.
So it's my own fault, but I've had a lot of cars where it's like, it's super cheap. It's like, I need a car right now. I don't really have the time or the resources to have some, like a mechanic look at it and whatnot. And so this one time, I had a car in Fargo that I wanted to buy, and it was another Impreza, also a manual. So I'm like, fucking great. And it was like the sport edition. So it had this like two-tone coloring. It was awesome. It was like everything I wanted. And my buddy, I was living in Williston, North Dakota at the time. So like the most upper northwest corner of the state. So I couldn't like really get there to just look at it. But my buddy Andy lived in town, and he was willing to go over and give it a test drive. And he's a car guy through and through. He knows manual transmissions and, you know, all that shit. And he also, we went to high school together. So he's seen all my other Subarus. He's ridden in Subarus. So like he knows what he's looking at. He was also kind enough to take it to a professional mechanic for me, like someone that he knew in town that he liked. They checked everything out. Like, it's great. Everything's checking out. It's perfect. I'm like, cool. The woman I was buying it from, her son himself was even a mechanic and maintained that vehicle personally. I'm like, great. Even had records of like having everything changed. It's perfect. I did all the legwork. I get down there. I look at the car. I give her the money. And she drives that car, and I drive with my buddy to the DMV that day because it happened to be like a Thursday or something.
Yeah.
And we sign over the paperwork. She officially takes the money. We go our separate ways. I shit you not, I drive 8 blocks. I am just about to hit the freeway to go back to Williston, and the car goes ba-boom. And I'm like, what the fuck? And my buddy Andy was I think he was behind me, and he was going to follow me until on the freeway until he hit his exit for his place. And then he was just going to go home, and I was going to go back to Williston. And he sees me at the very last second suddenly pull off into this grocery store parking lot that's right off of the freeway. And he's like, oh shit. So he follows me in, and I get out, and he's like, is everything okay? And I'm like, nope. And he's like, yeah, I kind of figured the way, because he saw that like I wasn't even in the turn lane. I mean, literally at the last second, I just zoomed over and like got into this parking lot. He's like, yeah, no. I figured there was an issue. And so I left the car running, and he's listening to it, and he can hear it going like clunk, 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 clunk. And he's like, I'm no expert. And he's like, but that sounds like your serpentine belt went out. And I don't know like anything what he's talking about, but the Subaru in question, and this is for basically every car, it was at like 98,000 miles, and serpentine belts you usually have to replace every 100,000 miles. So the one thing her son hadn't yet done was replace the serpentine. Yeah.
Yeah.
And much like you were saying, like it's an internal thing. So the belt itself costs like $20. But you have to tear everything apart, pull the engine out, take the engine like into multiple pieces, replace the belt, put everything back in, replace a bunch of gaskets, you know, give it a full oil change and overhaul and everything. So like it's a big process for a tiny little thing. So my understanding is that like her son just didn't want to do that. Like he was maintaining this vehicle for his mom for free. He's like, I don't have time or the resources to do all that shit. And so I called the lady, told her what was happening, and she's like, if there's any way I can help, let me know. And I think I was 23 at this point, and I'm just freaking out. Like, this is the first car I've bought, like, myself, like, without a parent involved at all, and I did the research. No, I think I was 25 or 26. Anyways, so apparently when the serpentine belt goes out, the whole point of the serpentine timing belt, the timing belt
thing.
Like they're kind of doing stuff, but like the timing belt keeps the pistons firing at exactly the times that they're supposed to. And apparently when they're out of sync, they just fly around randomly, like in the engine, and they can even like overextend. And so they'll, when the, like the, There's things that like pull in gas and air, and they're supposed to be pushed down when the piston is like all the way at the bottom. So if the piston isn't timing right, those valves might close and the piston will come up and hit them, and it will basically just destroy the engine. And so yeah. she was kind enough to come and meet me, and we brought it to a Subaru dealership and they checked it out. I ended up staying like overnight, and I called my dad and I'm like, "Dad, I might need another like $3,000 because this car just destroyed itself and blah, blah, blah." And he's like, "Well, Matt," he's like, "you should probably just ask for your money back. Like, this sounds like some fucking bullshit." He's like, "If I sold somebody a car, especially a young kid, and it destroyed itself not even a mile from my own house, I would feel compelled to just call it a wash and take it back." And I've already talked for a while about this, but longer story short, she did agree to just take the car, and she's like, "I'll have my son look at it." And yeah, and she hadn't even, like, I think I gave her a check, like, she hadn't even cashed it or anything, so she just gave it back to me, and I basically just put it back in my account, and I was like, "Well, that was a record." Because even Andy was like, after everything, well, and not to add more to, like, what you're already thinking about, but just, like, the things that you send me about, is it Mike, your roommate, Mike or Mark?
Mark.
Like, with any, like, anytime I feel like I'm just not living up to who I should be, just like as a good person or whatever, I cannot get the image of the butter with the hand grip marks on it out of my fucking head.
I need to like make a bingo card that just has all the crazy things on it, just to commemorate how insane it truly is. No, egos are real, that's for sure. Very large.
Did you say eagles are real?
Egos.
I knew I had to have misunderstood. I knew I had to have, but I'm like, that's what my brain heard. I'm like,
just put eagles are real and on the back, pigeons are not.
Eagles are real.
Pigeons are not.
Well, and it was so unrelated to what we had been talking about that I'm like, did I miss an entire, did I just black out like a whole thing?
I'm just glitching over here.
Yeah. Oh, fuck. Oh, it's just been that kind of week already.
Yeah. It has been.
That seems like a pretty good place to dive in. So, hello, everybody. Thanks for coming. This is Peculiar Pairings. I'm Matt.
Welcome. I am Celine. Welcome to our show where eagles are not real, but egos and pigeons.
Yeah.
I mean, egos are pigeons or not.
That should be a t-shirt. Eagles are real. And just no context. We will never explain what we were talking about.
Eagles are real. Pigeons
yeah, we're
real.
Just going to make eagles are real.
My podcast.
And then if anybody ever wears that shirt and it'll say, like, have a little Peculiar Pairings logo on it, people will be like, "What's with the eagle thing?" They're like, "I don't know."
If you know, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Which, like, even they won't really know, because we can't really explain what that even means, because it was just a misunderstanding of my stupid brain. Like, it doesn't really mean anything. It means I need ADHD medication and maybe hearing aids.
It's just life. Life is happening.
It is, you know? And you start getting older and shit starts breaking down. I have multiple coworkers who have become woefully aware of just how bad my hearing is at this point. Because I used to have a guy. Well, and I used to have a guy. We were all kind of this one group of friends right in a row. And one guy, Paul, used to work right on my right. And then buddy Jason's to my left. And Paul he bid to a new route, and we were all kind of sad at first. It was like, oh man, he might end up leaving our corner. And he just ended up moving three routes down and just to the other side. So he's like still within earshot.
He's just on the other side.
Yeah, but he's soft spoken enough and there's enough like ambient noise that I can tell when he's talking, but I can never understand anything he says. So I just feel like left out of the conversation most of the time. Because we'll have one of our coworkers be like, oh yeah, I know what you mean. And then I'll hear like, good one, Paul. And I'm like, oh, like I cannot understand anything. And it makes me sad.
That is, I have those moments at work sometime. There's just like so much going on that someone will ask me something. And I'm like, after like three times, I'm like, I'm sorry. One more time.
Yeah.
There's so much noise. And my brain just like, for whatever reason, it all comes in. And my brain is just like, let me just scramble this up like mush.
Yeah. Well, and then we're all also working. And so like your main focus is like all the mail that you're sorting and stuff. And so, yeah, if it's not really clear, my brain does not pick up on it at all. And I really feel bad because I'll always be like, what was that? Like, especially if they say, hey, Matt, like they're directly talking to me. I'm like, oh, I missed that. What'd you say? And then they say it again and I still don't hear it. And then I like, I like stop my work and I'm like, wait, say that one more time. And then I still don't understand. And then I'm just like, oh yeah, and then I just go back because I'm like, I cannot bear to like walk down there for a fourth time. Yeah, I'm like, I can't do it. And then sometimes they'll call me on it and they'll be like, you just didn't hear what he said, did you? And I'm like, no, they were moving a cart right behind me and the carts are so loud,
like the clinking wheel.
Yes. And they always, because it's just like metal crates on like metal wheels with metal, and so it's just loud as fucking. It's just that ka-cha-chung, 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 and
that one wheel's just like
yes
the whole time.
Mm-hmm. These were carts that were made like 50 years ago and we're still using them, which they're made out of like solid steel so they don't really break down, but it's like those wheels could probably use some grease. And like they have these crate like doors that kind of come down and they go ka-cha-chung. And it's like, you could probably put some lubrication on there and maybe not slam it so much. But
yeah, little WD-40 goes a long way.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it is a very special week for us. I want to say thank you to everybody because this is our 1,000 follower on Instagram show, which, I need to do more episodes. But for anyone who's unaware of what that means, we're flipping the script. So
yes,
normally Celine presents the story, but I'm going to do that this week. And that means that Celine has picked the pairing.
I have.
And I must say, it's pretty good. This. Really?
Yes, I was very excited, mostly because I felt like I could just go a little overboard with the pairing. Simply because, do you want to share our topic with us before I dive into the food and drinks? Cool.
So all that Celine was given is that the topic this week is the poet. And I was even going to say, like, if you need any inspiration or anything, like, for any little details to, like, help pick a pairing. And you were like, nope. Like, I already got something in mind. And I'm like, oh, okay. So, I'm pretty excited to share the story, and particularly I'm excited to figure out like if this has a connection. But so our topic is the poet.
Because I'm really not sure.
Well, I still have to make a guess because we've established that as like the thing now.
Yes.
So what is our pairing, Celine?
So I have our cocktail being called the Artist's Special. And then I have fig crackers with a berry goat cheese and honey.
Oh, crap. You got figs? Oh, no. Did I get the wrong ones?
Fig rosemary. Rosemary was the thing. Sorry, I just saw fig and was like, yes.
I got totally wrong.
I couldn't find the ones I wanted at Target and was like, well, I need it to be rosemary, absolutely. That's what I wanted, is the rosemary. That's what I wanted.
Because this is rosemary and olive oil.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Well, then I did get them.
Yeah. Rosemary was the key ingredient, because...
Oh.
For the cracker.
To go with the cheese, or yes. That's what, like, okay. Is there...
To go with the cheese.
Okay. And I will...
What are your thoughts on how they connect?
I'm not sure. I will say that, like, the artist special... when you sent me like the recipe for it, it did say while you read this poem, and I was like, okay, I feel like it's at least linked to a certain, is it linked to a certain poet that you like a particular writer? Oh, okay.
No, it is not.
Cause the, it's blueberry goat cheese with honey and rosemary crackers, and rosemary isn't like the name of a poet or anything like that.
Oh. No, I feel like when I tell you why I made this pairing, and you're like, are you fucking kidding me?
No. I think I'm going to feel closer to you than I ever have, because every time I think of a pairing, I'm like, this is so fucking stupid, and this doesn't make any sense. And so I feel like this is just going to make my day. Is it just that they're sort of like artisanal? Like that the cheese and the crackers are like quote unquote artisan.
So like level, kind or... of.
Okay.
More along the lines that I feel like a lot of artists specifically, like when it comes to poetry and stuff like that, are very pretentious and snobby.
Oh, okay.
That's why I was like, it has to be like rosemary with the goat cheese and like honey, because it's like over the top and just a little pretentious, but also nice. Very delicious. So it's, and then the artist special, just because I feel like sherry in general is just very much yes. like a artist drink. So then like the sherry mixed with the bourbon, I'm like, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it always makes me think.
Someone's drinking so much of this and they're fucking wasted at, yeah. like, some gallery opening being like, yeah, I just, like, threw some shit together, man.
Well, and if you've ever watched enough, like, I don't know if you watched the sitcom Frasier from, like, the late 90s. He's whenever, like, him and his brother get together, or whenever he has another sort of, like, upper crust person over, they drink sherry. And so when you said that, like, that was part of the recipe, I was like, oh yeah, this feels like a Fraser Crane kind of drink.
Yeah, it just, to me, just felt a little like bougie, pretentious, and like, I'm trying, but I'm not trying too hard because I'm an artist.
I don't want to look like I'm trying, but I'm trying. Yeah,
but I'm trying.
When I first read the recipe, my initial reaction was like, ooh la la, like, this is so fancy.
Yes. Oh, goat cheese.
Ooh. Well, and it's...
Sherry.
Sherry. Oh, we're treating ourselves. This is so exquisite. And then honey on top. Oh my. Am I a celebrity? I got
hot honey for mine to add a little cake.
Oh, interesting. I got literally the cheapest honey that I could find.
And, I probably would have also done the same if I needed to buy it.
And I only do that because it's like the little that I know about honey, there's not much that we do to it. So it's like,
no,
it's just honey. Like there's generally no reason to really pay more for quote unquote better honey. And I tend to have like such a garbage palate anyway, but like I'm not going to notice any subtle differences. So I'm like, I'm not going to spend more money on myself for like organic honey or something.
I'll maybe pay more for like local honey at a farmer's market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd do that.
Or like from a beekeeper, like an orchard or something.
That actually makes me feel bad because I just remembered there's somebody at work who does have bees and he sells honey. I'll have to make it up to him and buy some of his honey. Well, yeah. I was just like at the store and I'm like, I need honey.
Well, yeah, it's not like we had this planned super far in advance. Like I told you the food last night. So.
Well, and then I was happy that you sent it to me on Instagram as well, because I forgot that like my phone was destroyed. So I was lucky enough that while I was at work, I was already like listening to music and I had like an earbud in. And so when I dropped my phone and I picked it up, like I didn't even think there was anything wrong at first. I just put it in my pocket because the music was still playing and I kept hearing notifications coming in. So the next time I tried to look at my phone, it just, the screen stayed blank. And I noticed there was an exponentially larger number of cracks in the screen. And I'm like, oh shit. I'm like, I guess it's time to fix the screen. Yeah. That was just one too many drops and it couldn't take it anymore.
It happens. It does. It happens.
Well, I think that that is about all the ado that we require. First and foremost, diving into this story, I would like it came to me through an episode of the My Favorite Murder podcast with Karen Kilgariff and Georgia Hardstark. I've mentioned them before, and they certainly don't need any help from us. They're basically like the number one true crime podcast, like in the world everywhere.
Yeah, it's like them and Crime Junkie, my number ones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like the way that Karen described this story in their episode, it really struck me. And I hope that, you know, I can tell it as well. And when I started looking into it myself, I was actually surprised how hard it was to find information about kind of the core person
in this story.
Yeah. Although admittedly, that was a couple of years ago when I first heard about it. And I was like delivering mail in St. Paul and I was listening to their podcast and it helped me get through COVID and stuff. But there seems to be more buzz about this story these days, and I'll get into that at the end. But in a way, like the way that she talked about it and just like it being a podcast topic made me more confident in doing it, at least in the terms of like you and hopefully people listening to this not knowing about this story, because there's there's a really great sort of culmination of everything, like at the climax of this story, that I really love. So like, if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's going to be way better. But there are also certain reasons why this story got overlooked before. So I'll get into those later as well. But yeah, I'm just hoping that like most people haven't heard it and that it will go over very well. But for now, I just want to say that, of course, this podcast is not meant to be like a source of research. I'm not a journalist and I'm not a professional researcher. It is for entertainment purposes. So please don't get angry with me if I mess up some details. And in fact, I would welcome being corrected. So feel free to email us and let us know if there's anything that I missed. With that, my sources for this story were Wikipedia, a little bit on there. Excuse me. Medium.com, specifically an article written by Corey Mead, which was also published in the Truly Adventurous Digital magazine in 2021. Also what Karen Kilgariff references heavily in her episode. This kind of surprised me, but I found a little bit of information from thesun.com, which I believe is the same like sun that you see on like tabloid racks and stuff. So I'm like, I'm not sure how accurate their information is, but it was mostly about like, well, I'll get to it later. An article from a website called, I think it's mew.com. It's spelled meaww.com, so I'm not sure if it's pronounced or if it's just supposed to be like an initialism, but I also got a little bit from... So I'm just going to call it Mew.
Yeah.
Some stuff from truecrimedatabase.com, and of course, a very heavy helping from Karen Kilgariff and her telling of it from the My Favorite Murder podcast. And to be fair, that's mostly the way... The way that I'm going to be telling it is mostly the way that she told it, at least in the, like, presentation of facts and stuff. Oh, good. This is a perfect time for me to get, like, a frog in my throat. Yeah.
Mine is yawning. It's like, let's yawn right now.
Yeah. Or, like the other person starts talking, and that's when I decide to, like, take a bite of a snack or something, and then it's like, what do you think? And I'm like, just a second. Just give me a moment. I just have to hold on. Like Karen, I've tried to put this more in my own words and like my tone of voice. But she even admits that like in her episode, she's mostly going off of Ms. Mead's original article. And I feel like this is a story that more people need to hear, so we're going to do our own telling of it right now. Ooh, and I hope you enjoy it. Yeah. And without any further ado, I give you now the story of the poet. Yeah, just let that sit for a second. Okay, so our story ultimately begins with the birth of Ruth Smock on February 1st, 1930. She grew up on a small farm in rural Missouri. Yeah. You know, it's just kind of rural living. Her parents were simple farmers. Mm-hmm. They were strict and stoic, but she was reported to have had a pretty good childhood.
Kind of a weird question. Do you know if they were German? And I'm only asking that because Germans are known to be very stoic.
That's a good point. Well, they're not in the Midwest. I did not see that. That's a good question. I don't know if... I feel like Smock isn't a German name.
No. No, probably not. But...
yeah, like...
Just knowing... very stoic. I'm like, that sounds very German.
Well, yeah. And it sounds like the kind of... the kind of like demeanor you would have to like live through the Depression and the Dust Bowl.
True. Very like, true.
Yeah. You have to just not be affected by shit. Like,
yeah. That's a good point. That's a good point. It is the 30s.
Right. Well, and like, so the fact that she had a good childhood is really saying something because mm-hmm. as we already mentioned, like she was born in the Great Depression, basically, or like right before. And the Great, I forgot I wrote in a joke.
Oh, you did.
I'm gonna start that sentence over. She was born in a little thing we like to call the Great Depression, which is also a perfect name for our current election cycle. Hey-o!
Yeah.
I don't think
anybody's happy, to be fair. Like, it's not just one side, it's everybody.
No, yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. Well, and I just forgot that I wrote pretty much all of this on Sunday, and I was expecting it to take me, like, maybe 2 hours, and I started it at, like, noon, and I wasn't done until 9. And I was and it just kept going. Because I was kind of listening to her episode and like looking up articles, and before I knew it the sun was going down and I'm like, what the fuck have I been doing all day? And I'm like, I have to get this done.
Notes.
Oh my god. And then I completely forgot that I like wrote in little like notes to myself and like liner things. Anyways.
Yeah. Oh, it does get faster the more you do it.
For sure, yeah. I mostly need to stop getting sidetracked by my own little bits of insanity in my writing. Oh, okay, where was I? So it's the Great Depression, and like most people back then, of course, they didn't have a lot of money, but you know, they're getting by. They're living life. They're happy as you can be during the Depression. There's not much really to report on her early life. Obviously, there was World War II, the Holocaust. Those don't really affect our story, so. Life goes on.
Not much to talk about. She just, you know, lived through many major life events.
They don't really pertain to this story. You know, she was born in 1930. Not much shit happened. And then it's after World War II.
Okay.
But yeah, like we could do an episode on those other things later. Yeah. So, life just kind of goes on until 1945 when Ruth is 15. She moves from home to a boarding house in Fort Scott, Kansas to take a life prep course, or life prep courses like sewing and typing. And this
I was just about to ask what that meant.
Yeah, no, I didn't.
Life prep?
Well, and I was going
to
ask
you. They used to call, I think, like home ec, but now they call it something else.
Well, we didn't even have that. When I was in like middle school, they had just like the whole school system I was going through at that age, like, just kept getting money removed. And so by the time I got to the point when we would have home ec, they had already gotten rid of it, as well as, like, shop class and stuff. So the closest thing we had, and I was going to ask you if you had something similar, was called personal resource management. And so we took, like, an entire semester where they taught us how to manage a checkbook and, like, a bank account. And this is what happened when you get bills every month, and we would write out actual checks, and then we would put them in an envelope and we would mail them, and it was just such a weird course.
We didn't do that. We had like when I was in eighth grade, we had like a budget unit.
Okay.
They, and to be fair, I feel like this is not the fault of our teachers, just like the layout of it was really weird, where they're like, hey, we're going to give you, pick your career. We're going to give you a budget, except we're not going to tell you anything about how a mortgage works, how rent works, like how to do taxes, any of that. But you were expected to add all of that in your budget. Well, you rolled a die, like little dice, for how many kids you have.
Oh, wow.
What you were supposed to make.
Okay.
So, like, my career, because at the time, like, I wanted to do physical therapy. Like, I want to be a physical therapist. So I was like, okay, like, that's what I wanted my career to be. And they're like, so we don't really have, like, a set category for that, so we're gonna just put you as doctor. And I was like, cool. I was a doctor making 40K.
Oh,
with
wow.
Five kids.
Oh my God.
Like, it wasn't like I got to choose any of those things, or like the salary was comparable for what the career actually was.
Right, right.
And then because I didn't understand how exactly like rent worked or any of that, we're just like, they're like, well, like, you just, like, have to buy a house. And I'm like, but, like, what does that mean? And they're like, well, didn't your parents ever teach you this? No!
That's what the school is for! That's why we're doing this unit!
So then, I was in high school, yeah, it was, they tried the best they could with something that was very broken to begin with.
Sure.
And they,
I
like,
appreciate
made
what
it
they were going for
better, but I don't know how much better it was by the time Tori got to it. But we did have a class called Food and Nutrition in high school, which was supposed to be some sort of, like, home ec class. Like, we had units where, like, they were supposed to teach us things like how to sew buttons, how to, like, iron, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Most people took it as an easy A, and because they're like, hey, you get to, like, cook stuff.
Yeah, it's so really different from like any other course that you would just take in like the course of regular middle school and high school. So
yeah.
It's like, hell yeah.
I took it because it was an easy A. That's why I took it.
Fair. I appreciate the honesty.
Well, because I was like, well, like maybe this would be good for me like to learn more like better like nutrition, this and that. And then it was like, hey, we're going to learn for a whole week how to cook an egg.
A whole week?
Yeah, and then at one point, like, my teacher was gone for an extended period of time, so we just watched movies, and I'm like, well, at one point, we made jelly, we made crepes, and we did, like, muffins, and, like, talked about the difference of making, like, muffins versus, like, sweetbreads, and how to, like, switch the two up with different recipes.
Okay, that sounds
And that
pretty
you
cool.
can exchange them as is, you just change how long you cook it for.
Wow, I will be honest, I didn't even know that. I just learned that right now.
Yeah, the thing I wasn't thrilled about was when we did eggs each. So they had like four different kitchens and like each one was assigned a different way to cook an egg. And we got poached.
Oh,
with
God.
None of the proper tools to actually poach an egg.
Oh, no.
They're like, yeah, you just crack it in water. No, that's not what you do.
Like, okay, yeah, if you're going to break it down to, like, the most basic, like, theory of what a poached egg is, sure, you can say you just crack an egg in water, but there's way more technique than goes. I've never done it. I want to be very clear. I'm talking about, like, I know what I'm doing. I've never done it, but I've watched videos, and I'm like, I have no interest in eating an egg like that. That makes me want to try to make a poached egg.
Yeah,
it looks like
too much
work to just have an egg that I can just cook normally.
That being said, I do really enjoy like Eggs Benedict. I like it.
I've been hearing that a lot lately.
But
have you ever made your own hollandaise?
No,
I haven't either. Well, the only reason I even bring that up is because I've had one Eggs Benedict that I really liked, and I think Mimi made it like years ago, and I don't know if she made like a hollandaise sauce from scratch, but I've probably had Eggs Benedict like three or four times in my life. And I have never been a fan. I'm like, just give me the egg, like on the biscuit with a slice of ham, the hollandaise sauce, not for me. I don't know what it is. It's kind of, I don't know, like weirdly tangy, but I don't know how to describe it. It doesn't work for me.
I like different types of like eggs Benedict. So like my current favorite at the moment is like a Reuben style. So it's like the corned beef, Thousand Island dressing, a little sauerkraut in there. It's good. I'm a fan of that.
Okay. Yeah. And I think that's why I've tried it as many times. Cause I know the first time that I ever had it, I was not a fan of the Hollandaise sauce, but, I've tried it a few more times at various restaurants where it's kind of like a spin on what Eggs Benedict is supposed to be. So that sounds pretty good. Like, yeah, Reuben Benedict sounds pretty freaking tasty.
Yeah.
But yeah, but, like I said, we didn't have home ec. It made me sad.
Yeah.
Would have been fun.
So we didn't really have like a home ec style class. It was... Hey, we're going to teach you how to kind of cook stuff and watch movies.
Watch movies. Speaking of easy A's, in college, I took multiple courses. One was billiards, which we didn't really even like learn anything about billiards. It was just an A. It was an easy A. It was like just play. And we're like, okay. And then I took bowling, which was also mostly just an easy A because there was no real way to fail it unless you just didn't show up. But like a lot of us took it as like a fun way to either start your day, because a lot of the courses were offered at like 6 a.m. for some fucking reason. But I'm like, I do want to do bowling. But at least with the bowling class, we did actually have sort of like assignments, or it's like, we're going to bowl this way today. We're going to try, like, they really did try to like teach us different techniques and stuff. So it was fun and an A. But then, I just lost my entire train of thought. I was going for one more. I had one more easy A. And...
yeah. Dude, bowling and billiards.
Bowling and billiards. Come on, brain. Where were you going with this? It was based on typing. Jesus Christ. Well, I...
no idea.
I had a whole thing. I was like, speaking of easy A's. But I need to set this up with billiards and bowling first. Speaking of easy A. Well, anyways, I'm just going to move on because that's what my brain is telling me to do. So Ruth, what were we talking about? Ruth moves to Fort Scott, Kansas, to take sewing and typing. And this eventually leads her to getting a job at the local phone company. Life seems to be going, she's, you know, she's 15 and it's like she's working at the phone company. Remember when they didn't have laws?
Oh.
Although I suppose I had a job at 15, so that's...
I babysat. Yeah, that's
reasonable. Well, and you even took like a course thing. That was kind of a life prep course.
Kind of. I mean... Ruth, the adult child of 15.
And, real quick aside again, I still have not remembered what that thing that I was trying to go towards was. Because I was reading that she took a life prep course like sewing and typing, and for some reason it sparked a memory in my head, and I've tried to get back to that 3 times. Still can't remember. So, life seems to be going fine for her. She's working at a phone company, and everything's going good right up until her next year when she turns 16. So at 16, this is when our story takes a terrifying turn. It's 1946, and Ruth experiences her first in what will eventually become a fairly long string of unfortunate encounters with this same assailant that will shape the course of her life. She's returning from the grocery store one night. Yeah, we'll get there.
It's ongoing. Oh, yeah.
Right. So she's returning from the grocery store one night, and I couldn't find if she's like living with roommates or not, but she got off work. She's going home from the grocery store. She's got her groceries and she's followed home. And when I say followed, I don't just mean like the person learned where she lives and they've been like stalking her and like just kind of in the shadows and she doesn't know they're there.
Like she sees that they're following her.
She walks into her front door and is followed in by the assailant. She learns that they're following her because she walks in and like leaves the door open and goes to like put the groceries down, and she hears the door close. And that's when she turns around to see a 50-something white male inside her now closed door, and he attacks her.
Whoa!
Yeah, and I'm not even sure. I'm not even sure if she actually put down the groceries, but that's how this encounter starts.
No.
Yeah, he reportedly grabs her, pulls at her clothes, and she does fight back. She reportedly pushes her thumbs into his eye sockets, but he still managed. Yeah, right? Like, especially that day and age when this isn't kind of the age of, like, people being assaulted. This isn't at the forefront of people's minds. And she still has the forethought or the wherewithal to, like, fight back like that. Even with it's incredible. He manages to overpower her and he hits her with chloroform. And she apparently is like passing out. The last thing she remembers is seeing him heating an iron over the stove.
Ooh.
Yeah, not a great like last memory. And for any younger listeners who don't understand what I'm talking about, irons that you use like on clothing, they didn't used to be electric. So you'd have to like manually heat them up like either on like, you know, a stovetop or like an open flame. So that's what she sees him doing. It's like heating up just this piece of metal, which is not a great way to fall asleep.
No.
She later wakes up with multiple injuries, but of course the most prominent are second degree burns, one on each leg, and this wasn't in the research, but presumably in the shape of the iron. And as bad as that is, luckily her clothes are still intact. And when investigators get there, they rule out any sexual assault. As far as any records show, that attacker was never caught and never like identified exactly. So we're not really sure how it's linked. But as harrowing as that event was, not much happens. As much as I said it was like a long string, not much happens for Ruth in terms of that for a number of years. She manages to move on with her life and eventually meets and falls in love with a lovely man. On June 1st, 1950, Ruth gets married at the age of 20 to her basically lifelong husband, Ed Finley.
Ed.
Yeah, he's a sweet Ed. Guy. Yeah, and I'm just going to ruin this for a little bit. Don't worry, this isn't a story about like Ed cheating on her or anything. They live happily together for the rest of their lives.
Oh, God.
Yeah, they have a lovely marriage. Apparently, they're perfect for each other. It's just like the perfect sort of fairy tale ending. They're lovely. He's an accountant, so they're pretty comfortable. This leads to them moving to a quiet neighborhood in where else? Wichita, Kansas. Ruth continues her
Kansas?
Oh, did I do that differently? Oh, I think I might have messed up where I was supposed to put that. Well, we'll talk about Wichita in a second. Ruth continues her secretarial career. She's now working for the Southwestern Bell Company. She and Ed are living the quintessential 50s life. They have a lovely home, two sons. And oddly enough, I kept focusing on this. I could not find the name of their sons. Every report that I found said two sons, but none of them pointed them out. And I scoured Wikipedia. Neither she nor like her husband or even this like series of events has its own entry. I couldn't find anything else about like her family. We know about her and Ed and that they had two sons, but no names for the son. So I don't know if they did that on purpose, like they were trying to keep their son's identities a secret, but at any rate.
Probably. Yeah. I'd say that's usually the best place to find that stuff, especially if one of them is deceased, is find a grave.
Hmm. Well, shit, I'll have to keep that
in mind. That's how I've done a lot of, like, ancestry stuff is through that.
Is it findagrave.com?
Yeah.
Well, then I'm going to have to keep that in mind. And if I come up with more ideas later, I'll update everybody. Okay. Here we go. Now, I know I said earlier she has a long string of events. Oh, I think I already did that. Oh, yeah. So Ed and Ruth actually end up living mostly quiet lives for about 20 years. There really isn't much, kind of like during the Holocaust and World War II. There's not really much to report after their marriage and the raising of their sons. So luckily for them, not much happens until the 1970s. So they live a pretty long life. Their boys are both now raised, you know. And this is when we get to the real meat of her story. It all begins on November 21st, 1978, when Ruth is now 48. She's still a secretary at the phone company, and she's taking her lunch break to run some errands. She's just walking down the street in downtown Wichita. She's minding her own goddamn business. And when in her path... she's a woman of the day, you know? She's got an accountant husband. Her sons are off, presumably being successful, and she's enjoying her life in Wichita. She's walking down the street, and her path is suddenly cut off by a blue-green 1954 Chevy Bel Air. It stops right in front of her, and a man jumps out in sunglasses and a sweater covered by a jean jacket. And it's the 70s, so there isn't quite as much of an air of, like, immediate suspicion that we might have these days of, like, someone potentially assaulting you. So she's not, like, running away or anything. Yeah. It's broad daylight, so, you know... one wouldn't necessarily assume that like something bad or dangerous is happening, especially like this is just downtown Wichita, Kansas. It's like innocent 50s hometown living.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apparently the man gets out, kicks her right in the shin and yells, "Where's my money?" And now she's terrified.
Yeah.
And like, that's already
come up to you, kick you and scream, "Where's my money?"
Yeah. And like, that's already terrifying by itself, but the guy is apparently very smart. So when Ruth is, looking around for help, the nearest person she sees is an old lady that's like way down the street. So she knows she's not getting any help. So like, this guy knew where to find her and where to he picked his spot perfectly. And so she knows she's on her own.
Yeah.
So she's been kicked in the shin. Ruth falls over in pain. The guy takes the opportunity to push her into the car, and he starts sliding in right behind her in the back seat. There's no seatbelts being fastened. It's the 70s. You know, he's probably hopped up on coke or something. It's the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Quaaludes.
Oh, yeah, dude. But so he gets in the back with her, and that means there's another man in the car behind the wheel. He's apparently drinking from a bottle wrapped in a brown paper bag. Yeah, it's like classic. He's like just a hobo who has a car for some reason. Once the two are in the back seat and he shuts the door, the driver immediately takes off. So now she's in this car with these dudes and they're racing down the street. Luckily, Ruth keeps her wits about her. And through the pain and the adrenaline, she manages to slide across the door and she tries to make an escape. Very unluckily for her, whether it's by a plan of the kidnappers or just coincidental, it doesn't seem like a great car, but that door's handle is missing. So she can't open the door. She's trapped. And not only that, but she eventually notices that the car is just in shambles. So it's probably not planned. But there's like dirt everywhere. There's just random shit. There's apparently concrete and like pieces of chain, like on the floor. And she even reports that some of the dashboard is being held together with masking tape. So I think it's very safe to say that at the very least, bad vibes. Like this is a car of criminals.
Didn't Ted Bundy's car not have handles on the inside and the back?
Oh, I think you're right. Like, because it was kind of before the age of like child locks. So you couldn't just flick those on. Like you'd have to literally remove the mechanism.
He had a Volkswagen Beetle, so it might be just like that passenger door didn't have a handle.
Right. Well,
on the inside.
Kind of different from this situation. If I recall, he was known for being really sort of fastidious and like clean, like button down or whatever. So it's not just that, It wasn't lit, like the doors went into disrepair. He like deliberately
removed it. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So like he was planning ahead. These guys, maybe their car is just not taken care of.
They might not be. Got it.
Yeah. So the guy in the back seat starts going through her purse. He takes out a paycheck, a savings bond, and like he's just going through anything he can find of value. You know, he's probably thinking they've hit the jackpot. He's getting excited. And then he finds a business card that Ruth happens to have for a detective at the downtown police station. And apparently this enrages the man and he yells, "Oh, you no. damn stupid bitch." And as he says this, he picks up a broken piece of concrete off of the floor of the vehicle. Like we said, bad vibes. There's just loose concrete all over the floor. And he slams her in the head with it, knocking her out cold.
Oh my God.
Yeah, she's having a bad time.
Oh, Ruth.
Yeah. She's been through a lot already. And it's like, so happy that that's why I wanted to like mention that she and Ed are like always fine. Cause like, I feel like she needs a good part of her life. Cause like a lot of this gets really dark.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she has vague memories of places that they end up going. Conversations that the two men had, even about them talking about where they're going to dump her body eventually. She knows that this is not going to end well, and it's at this point she remembers that she has mace in her purse. But naturally she's terrified, you know, she's like frozen with fear and she doesn't want to make a move right now. So kind of like this is kind of why I brought up the earlier thing when she was 16. Because again, mm-hmm. she keeps her wits about her. She decides to wait and pick her moment. So she's good like, yeah. So I don't know if it's like she just happened to get lucky the first time because he did knock her out. But like now, you know, like she's in the mindset of like, I'm going to survive. And she's going to fight back again.
She's just not doing it hastily. She's trying to make sure that she can get away.
Exactly. Yeah. So she's going to pick her moment. And I definitely can't say that I would have the nerve to just like sit and wait. Yeah. And unfortunately for her, this is not a short ordeal. She's going to have to wait quite a while for that moment because they end up driving her around for hours. Yeah. And by the time that like the story is kind of progressing, it's already getting dark. It's getting cold. And she realizes that she's at the point where she can't just wait for a moment. She's going to have to try to create a moment for herself to get away. So she tells them that she needs to use the bathroom and they tell her that she needs to fucking hold it. And she insists saying like, yeah, I don't have to like go number one. I feel like I'm going to puke. And they say, well, we'll see if we can find you a bathroom, which it's a shitty car. So you wouldn't think they'd care, but apparently they don't want puke in their car. Yeah, it just goes to
probably
show that
just like the smell.
Yeah. Oh, what do they call it? Like sympathetic, like puking. If you see someone else or smell it, oh, that's gonna make you want to puke. And it just goes to show that like everyone, even scary hardened criminals, hate puke.
If you ever get kidnapped, be like, I will vomit in this car.
Yes. Well, I've heard that as like a recommendation from people for like self-defense is like piss your pants. If you're being assaulted by somebody with like a knife or just piss your pants, it's going to completely short circuit their brain. They're going to freak the fuck out and they're going to leave because they don't want to deal with that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that might be embarrassing, but that's if it works.
I feel like I would rather do that than be assaulted.
Oh, for absolutely. Yeah. If for whatever reason I knew that would work, like if I was sure that it wasn't just going to end up in me being a body that is like also murdered and has pee in his pants. If I knew for a fact that it would help me get away, I would do that in a heartbeat. Yeah, I'll pee my pants. Yeah. I don't know how well I would be able to concentrate on it, like in the moment, but if I had the choice and the state of mind, yeah, I would definitely pee my pants rather than being like a statistic.
Yeah. Okay. So she tells them I need to vomit.
Yes. I was going to say, I was trying to find my place again. Okay. So yeah, they don't want vomit in the car. They finally pull into a park, and again, it's dark, it's cold. They make her take off her sweater and her shoes so that she can't really run away. And like, they know it's getting dark, so they're like, well, she's not going to want to try to be out here in the cold without her sweater on. So the original kidnapper that put her in the car, he takes her into the park and he says something like, "This'll be fun. We'll go together. I'll watch you and you can watch me." Again.
Ew.
Yeah, really bad vibes. Just all around. Like every, even knowing that they're criminals, it's like they just keep making it worse.
I do not consent to this activity, sir.
Well, and it also made me think, like when I first listened to this, I don't think I paid attention to this particular detail. But it made me think of like when I lived in St. Paul or even now, like in Eau Claire, like parks tend to have bathrooms, you know, and like water fountains and stuff. But again, it's the '70s. So maybe they maybe don't do that yet. Yeah. So apparently they just walk to like a random spot, like by a tree or something. And he just unzips his pants. And so he's just going to openly pee in the park and he has to keep an eye on her. So he expects her to be right there and like watch her essentially. But at any rate, Ruth realizes this is her moment. Shoes and sweaters be damned. She grabs her mace. She sprays him with it while he's peeing and she just takes off.
Good for her.
Yeah. Like,
good for you, Ruth.
Yeah. It's a badass fucking moment. Like I like that. It seems like she took her experience from the first encounter and she's like, well, if this shit ever happens again, I'm gonna be ready. And she is. Yeah. So she sprays him with it, she takes off, and she doesn't have a specific destination. She's just trying to get away. She's just trying to put distance between herself and the dudes. So she finds a kind of big overgrown like bush that she can hide in. She like gets inside of it. Or behind it. It wasn't really clear when I found, but either way, she takes cover and you know, she's barely able to see cause she's like behind this bush and she's likely in a lot of pain. It's really cold. Or he's likely in a lot of pain. So he's not really chasing her at this point. He's essentially just stumbling around and yelling things to her. Like, you know, you're going to freeze out here. Come back and we'll be nice to you. We promise. Which obviously, if you're Ruth, go fuck yourself, pal. Like, like she's not going to fall for that. Her feet are apparently even starting to go numb, but she doesn't care. She's going to wait. She just stays put until the park is quiet. She kind of peeks out and she can see that the car is gone. Then she rushes out of the park as fast as she can. She goes to the nearest place, which happens to be a liquor store, and she asks the owner to call her husband, Ed. And already, you know, she's been gone the whole day. Like, she didn't go back to work. It's nighttime now. Yeah, so Ed has been worried sick. Unbeknownst to Ruth, he's already contacted the police. Tells them that she's been missing. This isn't like her. So when he hears from the liquor store clerk, he goes over there immediately. Coincidentally, she's already been picked up by the police. So presumably the liquor store clerk called them also or whatever, but she's been brought to the police station. When she and Ed reunite, she's obviously shaken, but she insists she's okay. You know, she's strong as fuck. She's Ruth. She knows how to deal with this kind of shit. She's fine. So all of that is obviously horrible and terrifying, but the interesting thing, and I kind of meandered around this earlier, Ruth actually was immediately afraid. But it wasn't because they startled her. It's because this isn't the first time she's encountered this guy. It's actually the third time, and it's the scariest of all the encounters that she's had.
No.
Yeah.
We'll what get happened into that the first two times?
We'll get into it.
Yes.